on the way in which Holden Village itself operates. But before I begin going into some of the details, some of my friends from the South will know a little bit about boll weevils. Boll weevils, of course, are the small insects that have for a long time attacked cotton crops. Well, as I was thinking about preparing this presentation tonight, I saw two boll weevils walking by my bed. There was a very large boll weevil, and it had on its back a sign that said, begin with a very serious discussion of the Forest Service. And then there was a smaller weevil that came right after it, and that had another sign on it, and that said, begin with a joke. So I chose the lesser of two weevils. The Wenatchee National Forest was first set aside from the public domain in 1897 by President Grover Cleveland. It was set aside initially as the Washington National Forest. And as the Washington National Forest, it continued for a number of years as part of the public domain. But the philosophy around a national forest in the late 19th century and the early 20th century was to maximize the economic potential of the national forests. And there were a number of reasons that fed into the establishment of the national forests and the particular philosophy of maximizing the economic impact. One of those significant factors was that as a number of explorers, including John Wesley Powell, penetrated into what was sometimes called the Great American Desert, that part of the country west of the 100th meridian, the 100th meridian going approximately through the center of the Dakotas and down through Nebraska, Kansas, and so on down to Texas, and embracing what is now the Great Plains as well as the Rocky Mountain states all the way to the Cascade Crest, that rather extensive area, about 1,500 miles in width, is either a semi-arid or an arid land, meaning that it gets comparatively little rainfall. And what rainfall it does get tends to come in patches where there is rapid runoff. As a result of that, John Wesley Powell and others who had explored this area knew that the federal government was going to have to take specific steps if it was going to settle all of these new lands west of the 100th meridian and make them a productive part of the national economy. Earlier, of course, in the eastern states, there had been the Homestead Act and many other acts that had encouraged the farming and other cultivation of tracts of land in relatively small quantities. However, in an arid or a semi-arid landscape, that is much more difficult. And so these pioneers realized that there was going to have to be a new management philosophy for these western states. And partly as a result of that, a number of these early political leaders, like Grover Cleveland and others, knew that they were going to have to reserve the forests that were lining the hillsides of many of the western mountain ranges. And they did that in order to preserve the natural cover and the soil retention values that forests provided. And in doing that, then, they could help make the natural cycle of water runoff more evenly spread and less inclined to heavy erosion, heavy gullying, and other deforming features of the landscape. In addition, they knew that they would have to come up with new strategies and new allotment specifications to allow pioneers in this area to develop larger acreages for ranches and for other kinds of large-scale uses that wouldn't have been appropriate on the eastern landscape, but was appropriate in these vast semi-arid and arid landscapes. So, among other things, they passed a series of acts that dealt with the use then of these national forests, which were set aside for their maximizing of the economic potential. As they did so, they realized that they were specifically granting to several economic interests concessional rates for grazing of livestock, whether it was cattle or sheep, for timber harvesting for various loggers and lumberers, for other kinds of uses on the public domain in the West. One of the key features of this public domain in the West, of course, was its use as a mining land. And under the mining law of 1872, anyone who was a citizen of the United States had a right to go onto public land, and on the public land to stake a claim if they found some rock or mineral that was of particular economic value. And they could then take these rocks that were of economic value, develop those rocks, and if they put a certain amount of economic investment into the development of these rocks, and then took reasonable and practical steps to bring these minerals to market, then after a period of years, if this effort continued, they would then get clear title to the land, so that land could pass directly from the public domain into private ownership upon the finding of these valuable mineral claims. Well, this is approximately what happened with John Holden, who came into this valley first in 1893, but who first found the outcropping of ore on Copper Mountain in 1896. And when he found that, he staked a claim and then several other claims that followed from that initial claim. Over the years, then, that claim ripened into clear title, which Howe Sound Mining Company eventually acquired and passed on to Holden Village when the gift was made to Holden Village. So that is how Holden Village has come into the possession of two parcels of land on the lower slopes of Copper Mountain. And it's the only section of privately held land in this valley, and one of the few sections of privately held land in this part of the National Forest. If you look at the map of the Wenatchee National Forest, you will see that in the northern section of the map, there are several small areas which are private lands as opposed to national forest land. And almost all of that, those specific spots, are the result of early mining claims. The northern end of Lake Chelan was a very popular mining district in the early years of this century, as well as the last years of the 19th century. And for just a minute, I will point out to you exactly where those tracks are. This is the map of the Wenatchee National Forest, and Railroad Creek Valley is up here. Here is the small parcel that is Holden Village land. And you will see here along the shores of Lake Chelan another string of parcels of privately held land. So we are surrounded by land held by the National Forest. Now, after the generation of Grover Cleveland and so forth, Teddy Roosevelt came on the scene. And I've headed the next caption on the outline as TR and all of that. Well, TR, Teddy Roosevelt, was probably the most popularizing sponsor of some of these Western developments. He truly believed that this national domain in the West could be used to enrich the whole country, and he took on the obligation of extending these national forests and other publicly held lands as much as possible. And he again adopted this philosophy that all of these lands could be used principally for maximum economic potential. That was the result of all of this activity in the latter part of the 19th century, and TR's formulation of this doctrine with the help of Gifford Pinchot, who was for a long time the chief forester under Teddy Roosevelt. And even today in southern Washington, you will find the Gifford Pinchot National Forest, named after this famous pioneer who worked along with Teddy Roosevelt on establishing these policies for the public lands. That was the way the situation continued then in all of the first decades of the 20th century. Now we come to another very important figure historically, the figure of Aldo Leopold. Aldo Leopold, as many of you may know, is one of the principal authors in the formation of the environmental or ecological movement. He was initially a forester who graduated with a professional degree in forestry from the University of Wisconsin. And while he was there, he had learned all of the techniques of maximizing economic potential on the national forests from the prevailing academic school of those days. His first main job outside of Wisconsin was in the Gila National Forest in New Mexico. And while he came to the Gila National Forest in New Mexico, the principal management objective of that forest at that time was for hunting. And it was believed that the Gila National Forest was a very good habitat for white-tailed deer, and especially was conducive to bringing large numbers of hunters to a relatively remote area of the American Southwest. So that the foresters who had been on the National Forest before Aldo Leopold got there had then adopted a policy of maximizing the white-tailed deer population by exterminating as many of the predators as possible. The thinking being that if they got rid of the wolves and the coyotes and the mountain lions and so forth, that they would automatically then increase the population of white-tailed deer. So for a number of years, they had sponsored bounty campaigns, providing public payments to those people who would bring in pelts of these various predators, like mountain lions and wolves. As a result of that, of course, many pelts were brought into the rangers, and a good deal of bounty money was paid. Well, initially, under these forest management practices, the number of white-tailed deer had increased. However, after Aldo Leopold had been there for a while, it was discovered that the number of white-tailed deer was inexplicably decreasing. And they couldn't figure out what was happening because the trappers and hunters were continuing to bring in the pelts of the mountain lions, the wolves, and the other predators. And it was thought that, therefore, the natural population of the white-tailed deer should be recovering. However, they began studying it in a little greater detail, and they discovered that what was happening was that as more white-tailed deer were brought into the national forest, they were overgrazing the kind of land that was left available to them. The predators had served as a natural check or balance on the size of the white-tailed deer population in the Gila National Forest. And without that natural check, the initial population of white-tailed deer did in fact increase. However, it increased to such an extent that the white-tailed deer started to starve to death and started other kinds of competitive practices within the white-tailed deer herds, which resulted in a significant decrease in the population of white-tailed deer in the Gila National Forest. So Aldo Leopold, having discovered that, wrote a series of recommendations to the National Forest that they should abolish their prior practice of paying bounty for the pelts of these other predators. And he also recommended, and this was very controversial at the time, that a certain core of the National Forest should be preserved as a wilderness area. They called it at the time a primitive area, or a primitive natural area, or a primitive research area. A center of the National Forest which would be untouched by any management practices of the National Forest Service. And in that core area of the wilderness then, or that core area of the forest, nature would be allowed to establish its own balance. And that balance then would be reflected in the peripheral areas of the National Forest and would, in turn, lead to an increase in the desired populations of wildlife. Well, they managed to do that in the Gila National Forest, but partly as a result of all of the controversy, Aldo Leopold had to leave the National Forest, took a sabbatical and went to Europe and did some studying with foresters in Europe, dealing with a number of the practices of forestry that occurred in Europe. And as he studied the European foresters' methods, he learned that their management practices were so extensive and so detailed that they no longer had retained any of the natural characteristics of the national forests in Europe. And as a result, he decided that it was not wise for the United States to adopt a policy of complete management of all of the national forest lands in the United States, but rather the United States should keep a series of core areas in their primitive condition with the minimum possible of management. And so he came back and did a good deal of research and also wrote a very popular book called The Sand County Almanac. And for those of you who have read extensively in the area of ecology, you almost certainly have read or at least seen copies of The Sand County Almanac by Aldo Leopold. If you are interested in becoming acquainted with some of the basic ideas of some of the forerunners of later ecologists and environmentalists, Sand County Almanac is a very good place to begin. Sand County Almanac simply refers to that area, Sand County, where Aldo Leopold then lived for a good deal of time and studied the natural cycle of seasons, of plant life, of animal life, and his relationship to them. And he wrote an almanac about those experiences and about those interrelationships. Well, as a result of all of these developments, the National Forests and the forest rangers on the different national forests began to have a series of ecological or environmental concerns that they needed to start applying to their forest lands. And as they did so, of course, they ran into considerable opposition from the lumbering interests, from the mining interests, from the cattle grazing and sheep grazing interests and other kinds of interests which had made use of National Forest Service land. During the periods between the 1930s, when Aldo Leopold began his popularizing of some of these ideas, up to the 1970s, most of the decision-making power in terms of who would get concessions to National Forest Service land and how much those concessions would cost was left up to the individual ranger or the superintendent of a given national forest. As a result, all of these different interests could bring both political pressure to bear on the ranger or the superintendent, but also bring economic pressure to bear, because by not leasing land or by leasing it in patterns which were not particularly conducive to the national forest, the ranger could be put at a very significant disadvantage and forced to cooperate, in effect, with the desires of these different economic interests. As you can probably tell, many of the lumber companies, for example, which wanted to do extensive timbering on the national forest, avoided a lot of cost by not having to grow the trees, maintain the trees, protect the trees from fire or other kinds of hazards, but simply sell the trees at the commercial rate, buy them from the forest at a very low rate, subsidized in effect by the federal government, which not only provided the land and the trees, but also all of the protection and all of the other services that went along with maintaining this vast tree farm. And in one sense, you can view all of the national forests of this country as a vast tree farm, comprising hundreds of millions of acres, all cultivatable as trees or as other vegetation, and much of it talked about in the timber industry as simply a harvesting process. Well, as a result of all this personal discretion vested in the hands of the forest superintendent or ranger, it became apparent over a number of years that some guidelines were needed for the ranger or the superintendent to follow in the quest to provide public input and public participation in the whole process of which kinds of interests could have access to national forest land. Among other things, after the 1930s and 40s, the use of the national forest for recreation, including fishing, hunting, scenery, viewing, hiking, picture taking, as well as organizational camps and all of the other kinds of recreational and aesthetic uses of the national forest land, all of that continued to increase. And of course, the pressure is on the rangers and the superintendents to yield to those pressures and to provide National Forest Service lands to some of those uses increased. As a result of this pressure, the Congress finally passed in 1976 an act requiring that each of the national forests provide a plan by which they would then organize their national forest and set out a series of criteria for the use and development of each of the different divisions of the National Forest Service land under their jurisdiction. And these plans were to be adopted in a series of stages. And after 1976, then, for the next 5 to 10 years, up until about the present time, in 1986, many of the eastern national forests have been done. They have developed their own planning process. As a result of that planning process, they have then developed a specific plan to implement on their national forests. And as a result of that, then, have come up with a series of specific uses for the different sections of their National Forest Service land. However, the Western National Forest, being in general much larger and in some respects more complex than some of the Eastern National Forests, have been coming along in the 1980s, first developing their planning process using many of the Eastern forests as their example as to how to do the planning, but then also developing some specific applications or uses for the Forest Service land under their jurisdiction. Now, if you look at a map of the national forest that we're in now, the Wenatchee National Forest, you will notice that it extends for approximately 125 miles north and south. It goes approximately from North Cascades National Park down to south of Mount Rainier National Park. And it extends east and west on an average of between 25 and 55 miles. So it's a fairly significant size of national forest. It's over 2 million acres in this national forest alone, and is one of the most popular national forests in the country in terms of the number of visitors who either come to the national forest or participate in some sort of recreational activity in the national forest. And of course, everyone who comes to Holden Village is one of those recreational users of the national forest. But in addition, if you look at a map of the Wenatchee National Forest, you will see intermixed with the National Forest Service land a series of other kinds of land. The state of Washington has a number of tracts of land very close or next to the National Forest. And how it decides to manage its land next to the Wenatchee National Forest will also have a substantial impact on the way in which the Wenatchee National Forest can use its land. In addition, as a result of the building of the railroads west across the continent, the federal government provided to those railroads a series of land grants, giving the railroads every other square mile in a checkerboard pattern out on each side of the rail line from 10 to 40 miles. So that each of these railroads acquired strips of land in a checkerboard pattern of square miles extending on either side of the railway by 10 miles. Expanse then would have been 20 miles, and that was for only the narrowest grants of land. The widest grants of land went up to 40 miles on either side of the railway, which would have yielded a full expanse of 80 miles on either side of the railway right-of-way. And as you look at the map of the National Forest, especially on the fringes near the Columbia River, and again over on the western side of the Cascades, if you look at the maps for the Mount Baker or Snoqualmie or other national forests out there, you will see in many cases near the Puget Sound area a similar checkerboard pattern occurring. And the reason for that checkerboard pattern is these railroad land grants. And the railroads have continued to this day to hold millions of acres of land in the western United States, and especially the mineral rights to millions of acres of land in the western United States. And that is a part of the planning process whenever a national forest or a state forest or any private interest is considering the uses to which national forest land will be put. There are, in addition, a number of specific factors that the Wenatchee National Forest is going to have to look at in developing its plan for the use of the Wenatchee National Forest. Among other things, a very high value is placed in this part of the country on the recreational use of the national forest. And that comprises a number of specific elements. It comprises both the scenery, the aesthetic quality, the wildlife, the the vegetation as well, both the trees as well as the smaller vegetation, the bushes and shrubs and ground cover as well. So that all of these things are going to have to be considered as a part of the Wenatchee National Forest planning process. Right now, the Wenatchee National Forest has examined all of the different possible uses for the Wenatchee National Forest and has come up with a proposed management plan. It's called a Proposed Land and Resource Management Plan for the Wenatchee National Forest. It comes in a volume this size, which is about 400 or 500 pages in length. If you want to get a brief summary of it, you can find it in this reviewer's guide and response form. Their proposed land and resource management plan has been developed over the last several years, and in order to develop it then, they opened to public comment the entire planning process. And as they opened to public comment the planning process, of course, many people testified at their initial hearings, which were held in a number of parts of the state, most of them close to the Wenatchee National Forest, but they also held hearings in a number of the areas around Puget Sound where much of the population of the state lives. And they are, of course, obligated to take into account not only the public comment of those people who live in the National Forest or immediately adjacent to the National Forest, but anyone in the country, since the entire population of the country, in a sense, owns the Wenatchee National Forest. As a result of their proposed land and resource management plan, since that plan is going to have a significant impact on the environment, they also had to develop then an environmental impact statement. And I have here in my hands a copy of their draft environmental impact statement. Because after they held these initial hearings and arrived at a proposed plan, they then had to consider the environmental impact. And the environmental impact statement is considerably longer than the actual proposed plan itself. This one would average somewhere in the neighborhood of 500 or 600 pages, at least. And then to accompany that draft environmental impact statement, they have a series of indices and appendixes which go on for another 600 or 700 pages at least.
Can any forest left after you cut all those trees down to make the paper?
That's right. There are only a few people who could actually get through all of these documents. And whoever the National Forest has who works with these proposals has to spend a considerable amount of time not only developing the documents themselves, but also the definitions of all of the different terms that are used in forestry management. And I know some of you have spent a considerable amount of time with forestry practices or with people who have been involved in forestry in one sense or another. In fact, several weeks ago, we had here a similar discussion around the also around the Wenatchee National Forest Plan. But it involved Carl Johnson, who has worked for some 10 years with the Washington Department of Forestry and knows a good deal about different forestry practices. There are several forestry practices which the proposed land and resource management plan refers to, and as a part of that plan then, the Forest Service has developed a number of alternatives. Those alternatives are listed as alternatives A, B, C, D, E, F, G, H, and I. So there are a number of different possibilities for the National Forest and how it is to be managed. The Wenatchee National Forest supervisor and the people who wrote the plan prefer alternative C, which I have a map of here posted on the wall, and you can, after the session tonight, or even now if you would like, examine the different alternatives on the maps. Those maps serve then as a guide to the different uses for the different parts of the National Forest, given different management objectives. There is one alternative of the National Forest Service plan, which simply maximizes the harvest of timber, maximizes the potential for grazing. That is not the alternative that the Wenatchee National Forest officially prefers, however. There is another alternative which essentially tries to preserve virtually the entire land of the National Forest with no development at all. The preferred alternative, number C, is the alternative that allows for a continuation, in most cases, of the uses that are currently existing on the National Forest, as well as providing for some minimal expansion of timber activities, and also for some expansion in the wildlife possibilities on the National Forest. It doesn't maximize those potentials, but it does provide for some increase in them. And as such, it meets most of Holden Village's concerns. And as a result of the whole planning process, Holden Village's concerns as of this time are largely addressed satisfactorily in the preferred alternative. However, there are some important provisos to make at this point. One is that the Forest Service could very easily adopt alternative C for the National Forest as a whole, but change the designation for this valley and the part of the National Forest closest to it for some reason dealing with public pressure. It could change the designation of this valley or the proposed uses for this valley as a result of the actions or inactions of Holden Village itself. It could change a number of other factors that would have a major impact on Holden Village if it changed some of the designations dealing with Lake Chelan and some of the transportation systems that are attendant upon that. So that even if alternative C is in fact adopted, that doesn't mean that Holden Village is necessarily without any concerns or worries in terms of how the National Forest Service plans. The National Forest Service is going to be planning not only, remember, for the next 10 years, but is projecting this plan as far as 50 years into the future. And as such, even small changes in the immediate future can produce very large effects 20 or 30 or 40 years from now down the road. Let me just talk for a brief time about some of the concerns that Holden Village itself has and the particular kinds of needs that it has from the National Forest. One thing that Holden Village uses extensively is a whole network of trails very close to the village, going east from here down to 10 Mile Creek, down Railroad Creek Valley to Dom Key Lake, going west from the village into the National Wilderness area of Glacier Peak. And of course, one of the key ways in which the use of Holden Village, of this property, can be criticized is the number of people and the kinds of uses that it brings directly adjacent to a wilderness area boundary. And directly east of the Holden Village, or directly west of the Holden Village use area, begins the National Wilderness Area. Directly south of Holden Village's property on Copper Mountain, the Glacier Peak Wilderness Additions begin, so that all of the trails and all of the resources of this valley are in one sense keyed to the existence of this wilderness area essentially on our doorstep. In addition, Holden Village needs to maintain the road between here and Lucerne. The road itself is a National Forest Service road. It's not a Holden Village road, but it's important that Holden Village continue to have access to it and that such major repairs or reconstruction of the road as would be needed could be done in an orderly fashion. And so it's important that the resource management plan allow for sufficient reconstruction and repair to the road to keep it at least in its current condition. In addition, Holden Village uses hydropower from the small area on Copper Basin from which water is funneled down to the hydroelectric generating plant that is maintained by Holden Village. That's a use of that hydropower that has been established for over 30 years now. Nevertheless, it is something that is based upon the willingness of the Forest Service to continue to permit that kind of use. In addition, just about everyone who comes to this valley comments on the size, the extent, the color, and the composition of the tailings piles that come from the waste rock from the milling process that Howe Sound used in extracting the copper and other minerals from Copper Mountain. These tailing piles should at some point be reclaimed, and it's not going to be possible to reclaim those tailings if there is a pure preservation limitation put on the uses of the Forest Service land in this valley. As many of you probably know, since you've been on the mine hike, or if you haven't, if you do come on the mine hike or come to a lecture on the history of the Holden Mine, you will learn that the tailings are on Forest Service land. They cover about 80 or 90 acres of U.S. Forest Service land and comprise approximately 8 to 9 million tons of waste rock. This was rock that was generated as a part of the Howe Sound milling process and contains very small quantities of copper and gold and other materials. However, the quantities of these valuable minerals is very small indeed compared to the vast quantity of rock actually in the tailings. Those of you who have noticed the orange color of the tailings know, of course, that that is rust from the iron in that waste rock. Now, Holden Village has had a long-standing interest and desire to do something about reclaiming the tailings and returning them to some sort of arable use for wildlife, for vegetation, for the pure safety and cleanliness of the valley, both in terms of its water and in terms of its air. But of course, the tailings were not put there by Holden Village, and any effort to reclaim the tailings or to modify their existing uses is going to have to require cooperation not only from engineering firms and others, but also from the U.S. Forest Service. Right now, this is September of 1986, many of the studies of the tailings that have been done are in the hands of an engineering firm in Tacoma, Washington, Whitaker Engineers, which is studying again the possibilities of reclaiming the tailings and possibly extracting from them that minimal amount of mineral wealth that may still be in them. It's conceivable that there may be enough mineral wealth in there to actually pay for the process of reclaiming those tailings. However, whether that is in fact going to be realizable in an economically sensible way within the next few years is a matter that is still open to study and question. Nevertheless, that is a continuing interest that Holden Village has in this part of the valley and in reclaiming the tailings. In addition, Holden Village has continually for a number of years bought a small quantity of wood to be cut from the National Forest. It's about 100 cords of wood a year, I'm told, which is a relatively small amount of wood, certainly less than the replacement value or the replacement quantity of wood that would be replaced in the land owned by Holden Village itself. Which brings me to another point. In the past, Holden Village itself has proposed a series of steps to use those parcels of land which it owns on the southern slopes of Copper Mountain for purposes of a tree farm. And I believe somewhere between 60 and 100 acres of the lower slopes of Copper Mountain could feasibly be used in terms of farming timber for the use of Holden Village itself. However, right now, nothing is being done about that, in part because the Science and Technology Committee, which has in the past had fairly regular meetings, is no longer active. So if there are those of you who are interested in science and technology, your interest in reestablishing the Science and Technology Committee is invited. But that is one of the kinds of uses that Holden Village could put its lands to. By clearing away some of the old and decaying wood and planting in a reasonable pattern new types of trees, and trees that would be conducive both to variety of vegetation and to wildlife habitat, and that those trees then could be harvested right from Holden Village land itself. So that is one of the other factors that Holden Village is interested in in any new management procedures attempted by the Wenatchee National Forest. Now, I've put on the board the outline of what I've been saying so far, along with a general area for your responses. And let me change the board, and I'll show you a little bit about some of the things that perhaps you could do in response to some of the things that the Wenatchee National Forest has been involved in. The Wenatchee National Forest is accepting comments until October 1st of 1986, which is about 2 weeks away, in care of Donald Lyons, whose headquarters is in Wenatchee, Washington. The zip code is 98801. And any public comments are welcome for the Wenatchee National Forest, and so you can assume that they will be receiving and have received literally thousands of letters and other comments from people, not only in this part of the state, but from throughout the country. Among other things, as I noted a few minutes ago, there are a number of major economic interests, such as the railroads, large timber companies, and others, who have a major stake in how the Wenatchee National Forest operates its land. That's certainly true of Holden Village as well, but I think some of those other organizations probably have sent in far more extensive comment than Holden Village has had time for so far. For those of you who are interested in reading some things about the environmental ethic and some writers who've written extensively about the environment and ecology, I've put up on the board three books that I think are interesting and kind of fun to read too at the same time. They're not particularly heavy reading, and they don't specifically address the Wenatchee National Forest Plan, but they do address some of the general issues involving the national forests and their uses. And one is the classic by Aldo Leopold, The Sand County Almanac. Another author is Edward Abbey. Edward Abbey, for those of you who are from Utah or Nevada or some of those areas of the high desert of the southwestern United States, probably know that he is a very famous commentator, author on environmental topics. He's written and authored not only books, but calendars, magazine articles, and journal articles of all kinds. I put on the board two books by him. One is The Monkey Wrench Gang, which is about the dam at Lake Powell. And here's another one that the bookstore has in right now, and it's called Desert Solitaire, also about the high desert of the Southwest. But it addresses many of the concepts of the wilderness, which are very similar to the concepts of wilderness which govern Glacier Peak Wilderness here in this valley. And so if any of you are interested in finding out more about the general topic or the perspective in which many environmentalists hold some of these values, some of Edward Abbey's books, such as Desert Solitaire, are very instructive, and they're very available in the bookstore right here in Holden Village. Now, the Railroad Creek Valley right now is classified under the preferred alternative as ST1, which is defined as scenic travel retention. And that means that travel is going to be permitted by motorized vehicle in that section of the National Forest. However, the travel that's going to be permitted has as its primary purpose that of viewing the scenery and considering the other aspects of the National Forest that can be seen while driving through it. In addition, it's classified as a retention area, which is less restrictive than a preservation area, which is simply allowed to return to the state of nature without any attempt to manage it at all, essentially a wilderness kind of designation. Retention simply means that there will be some cutting of trees, some cutting of brush and shrubs, and some other kinds of management practices will be permitted on National Forest Service land, but only if it continues to create a natural appearing landscape so that the average visitor to the National Forest or to this scenic travel area will not be able to notice any of these management practices. And of course, it can be a retention area because the tailings and the other improvements or changes, at least, I don't necessarily think the tailings are improvements, but changes in the valley have occurred historically prior to the implementation of this plan. Certainly, if Howe Sound Mining Company were coming in here today, it would not be allowed to pile tailings on National Forest Service land. Nevertheless, there are certain characteristics of this designation of ST1 that are particularly important. And the definition of ST1 goes on for some 6 pages of very detailed points. And I thought I would read a few of them now. Basically, it allows for cutting of trees, but only in a way that is consistent with the aesthetic quality of the scenery to be enjoyed in the valley. It allows for enough trail construction and reconstruction to continue the sort of hiking and other recreational uses which are going to be allowed and desired in the valley. The roads are to be maintained to provide a maximum recreational use for those who simply want to view the scenery and the mountains and the various qualities of the National Forest from a car. And with regard to water and soil and minerals, it allows for a rehabilitation of degraded sites caused by management activities, in this case prior management activities relating to the tailings. In addition, any buildings to be built or to be remodeled in the valley will need to be harmonious in structure and color and so forth with this scenic kind of quality that they are trying to achieve in this region. In addition, they want to encourage at least a few small patches of what is called old growth timber. And old growth simply means virgin or untouched timber, timber that has not ever been logged or replanted, but is simply the timber that was standing there in its native state and allowing to regenerate itself. Most of this valley has at one point or another had a good deal of logging operation on it, so that there are many areas of this valley that do not have old growth timber, and much of the forest that you see around you from the village has at one time or another been logged in whole or in part. However, there are a few small stands of old-growth timber in the valley, and that is one of the things that they want to maintain then under this management option. So, I think I've probably talked enough. Do you have some comments or some questions about the National Forest plan, about some of the other aspects of what goes on in a national forest? Yeah.
Will these tailings on here support vegetation?
They won't in its current state in any large sense. The tailings right now have an acidity that is approximately that of pickle juice. And if there are those of you who have ever tried to do any gardening, just try watering your plants with pickle juice and see how far you get. They don't grow very well.
Idea. Every visitor brings an extra suitcase and takes it home full of tailings.
That's right. And in fact, I was the comment for the tape was that every visitor should bring home a suitcase full of tailings after they leave here. And I was talking with one of the Forest Service guards earlier this summer, and she said that that would be a good idea, too, to get rid of them. She was using it, of course, only jocularly, since there are some 8 million tons of tailings out there, which is an enormous quantity.
Well, Rome wasn't built in a day.
That's right.
You feel that the Holden Village and our board and so forth is in general a cooperative relationship with the National Forest Service, or is it at times in an adversarial relationship?
For some years, my understanding is that the Holden Village Board and the entire operation of Holden Village has been very cooperative with the Forest Service, and I know personally many of the people who are very active in the village have many of the same values and same ideas about the use of natural resources that are very similar to many of the values and approaches of many of the environmentalists. In general, the relationship with the Forest Service has been very fine and very cooperative. I think in the first years of Holden Village, there were some problems, probably between Holden Village and the Forest Service. But that is quite a few years in the past and is no longer the case. We want to continue that quality of relationship and that quality of cooperation between Holden Village and the U.S. Forest Service. And part of that cooperation involves our knowledge of what the Forest Service is looking for in the National Forest, what we can perceive of the Forest Service's needs, of the kinds of values or kinds of ideas that the foresters are going to have about the uses of the National Forest. It isn't an interdependent relationship because the Forest Service is in no way dependent on Holden Village. However, Holden Village is almost entirely dependent on the Forest Service, since all of the land around Holden Village, as well as the land under the buildings itself, is Forest Service land, and they could close off their services without the consent of Holden Village. Now, that would take a considerable legal maneuver if they were going to do that, but at the same time, Holden Village does remain very much dependent upon the goodwill of the Forest Service. And so if there are interests or needs of the Forest Service, Holden Village needs to take those into account and act upon them very responsibly. That doesn't mean that Holden Village needs to do anything or everything that the Forest Service says, but we have to address those concerns very responsibly in order to continue to have a very good working relationship.
Well, who is it that votes on which plan you choose? Is this an elected official or appointed? Or
the person who actually chooses, the person who actually chooses is the superintendent of the National Forest. The superintendent.
And who is that?
The planner is Donna Lyons, and I don't know the name of the actual superintendent offhand for the Wenatchee National Forest. Donna Lyons will make his report to the superintendent of the Wenatchee National Forest. The superintendent will make his report to the regional forester, and the regional office is in Portland, Oregon, and those people in Portland don't really know anything about Holden Village other than what they've heard indirectly. The people who actually work on the Wenatchee National Forest in many cases, if not all cases, already know a good deal about Holden Village. Many of them have been here either passing through or for periods of time. But once it gets to the regional level, then of course the regional forester doesn't necessarily need to adopt the standards of the superintendent of the Wenatchee National Forest. From there it goes, of course, to the director in Washington, D.C., the one who's in charge of the Forest Service as a whole. From there, of course, it goes up to the Secretary of Agriculture, who is appointed by the President and is a member of the Cabinet. Usually any conflicts will be resolved before it gets that far. And then, of course, the President can overrule whatever the Secretary of Agriculture says. And of course, Congress can also have its say. Just one last question before the bell.
How many acres are involved in Holden Village?
In Holden Village.
How many acres are we talking about when you talk about Holden Village?
When we're talking about Holden Village right here, the village itself, we're talking about less than 40 acres probably. When we're talking about Holden Village as well as the roads that we use over to the edge of the National Forest, over to the edge of the National Wilderness Area, the roads over to the Miner's Village and up to the museum and the entrance to the mine, the acreage on the lower slopes of Copper Mountain, we're talking about at least several hundred, perhaps 1,000 or 1,500 acres. And the tailings themselves come in at somewhere between 80 and 90 acres. And I think I'll have to thank you all and wish you good luck on your way to Vestwood.